What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. On today's show, we will be speaking to none other than Seth Harp, the author of The Fort Bragg Cartel, Drug Trafficking and Murder in the Special Forces. And very excited to be talking to him because it's an excellent, excellent, excellent book. And it reads like a mystery, even though it is nonfiction and it just fell. But that's OK. It's good for dramatic effect. And we are also going to be talking to two people who are being punished as we speak for their pro-Palestine activism. And that is Hadika Arzum Malik and Dr. Karina Mullen. And we'll get to their biographies later on. But before we start with Seth, which I'm so excited to do, please do like the stream. Just give it a thumbs up. That's a really easy way to support this show. Also, subscribe if you haven't already. We're at almost, we're at over 350,000 subs. We want to get to 375 soon. Then we want to get to 400,000. But again, liking the stream is a great way to support the show and push back on the evil algorithm so that, you know, people like Barry Weiss don't do better than we do online. That would be very nice. And let's see. I think we're just going to get started with the show because we are starting a little bit late and apologies for that. Thank you for your patience. We had some tech issues, some other issues. So we're going to bring on Seth Harp. And Seth Harp is an investigative reporter and foreign correspondent who writes about the intersection of armed conflict and organized crime, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. He has reported from countries including Iraq, Syria, Mexico, Ukraine, and elsewhere for Harper's, The New Yorker, The Intercept, and Columbia Journalism Review. He's also written for The New York Times and The Texas Observer, and he has completed the book for Viking Press about drug trafficking in the U.S. Army Special Forces and a series of unsolved murders at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And that is, of course, the Fort Bragg cartel that I was just speaking about. So welcome, Seth.
Hey, Katie. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining. You know, you are such a great guest to have on because you can speak about so many different issues because you cover so many different issues. And we're going to start with what you cover in your book, but then we're going to shift into lots of questions and topics related to current events. So before we get into the story, the fascinating story that you cover, stories that you cover in the Fort Bragg cartel, what is it that you want people to make sure that they take away from your book?
About the people responsible for the murders at the center of the book are still out there, still on the loose, haven't been caught.
Okay, that's important. Yeah.
Would be number one. Maybe also to emphasize how out of control some of these elite military units are, like Delta Force, how little accountability there is over the Joint Special Operations Command, how much they're able to get away with and conceal and not have to be accountable to the public. How they can just have like dead bodies turn up on base and then just kind of shrug and have that go away and never be explained. And these are all things that we should be concerned about.
Yeah, well, those are all great and extremely important things. So just so people understand, tell us what Delta Forces are and the JSOC? Yeah, JSOC, yeah.
Delta Force is the most elite unit in the U.S. military. It's an army unit. It's an elite raiding and reconnaissance force that was created in 1978 or 9 or so. that was originally intended to be for super niche missions. Like if there were hostages being held, or if there's like a nuclear weapon that was loose, it was on the black market or something. Delta Force was supposed to be like the president's, you know, go-to, where he could deploy this small group of guys to take care of something that just absolutely had to go right. You know, no fail mission is what they call it.
Right.
But it really hasn't. It's evolved to be something different than that over the years, through particularly after 2001 and after the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's evolved into something a lot more, a lot bloodier, and a lot scarier in many ways, and a lot bigger as well. JSOC is a larger formation that exists around Delta Force. I think it's helpful to think of JSOC as the superstructure that enables Delta Force. The Joint Special Operations Command, just as secretive, you know, the government doesn't even officially admit that these units exist. So that applies to all of them. And JSOC is based at Fort Bragg. Delta Force is based at Fort Bragg. But JSOC also includes other units from other military branches. Most importantly, SEAL Team 6, which is a lot better known than Delta Force, much more in the sort of public limelight. But those two units are the main components of there's other units as well. There's Air Force units. There's more exotic, like eavesdropping and reconnaissance surveillance units. But mainly it's Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 is what we mean when we talk about JSOC.
Okay. And now I heard, before I read this book, I heard you doing an interview with Abby Martin and Mike Preisner. And I was like, stop giving it away. Stop giving away what happens. But what's fascinating is that there's this murder that happens at the beginning of the book, but that's like only part of it. So it's actually not giving away, because you learn about it in the opening pages. Talk about this murder that you open the book with, and that's kind of the narrative device, this murder mystery for the book. And also we'll throw onto the stage, once you start talking about them, the two men, the murderer and the murdered man, when you're talking about them, so people know what they look like.
Sure. In 2018, a Delta Force soldier named Billy Levine, who had severe PTSD, he'd done 14 deployments with the units, and had served in the assassination program in Afghanistan and Iraq, that I talk a lot about in my books, which is what Delta Force kind of got into and became their wheelhouse after the surge in Iraq. They became an assassination team that was, you know, the main warfighting effort for years and years in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Levine had been through this ringer many times, and he had severe moral injury, PTSD, combat trauma, and he had a severe drug addiction. And so did his buddy, Mark Leshiker, who was his best friend, a fellow Green Beret. Not nearly, you know, he wasn't a member of Delta Force. Yeah, there's a picture of him. Great. That's Levine on the left, you know, and that's Leshiker on the right.
Holding the weapon.
Yeah. So the guy in the formal uniform is one of the most elite military operators in the United States. Truly top tier, as you can see from all of his ribbons and decorations. He looks like a ghost, because at that time that photo was taken, he's been smoking crack cocaine every day and using heroin every day for months on end. And has recently killed people stateside. That picture was taken in December 2018. And 7 or 8 months before that, he had killed the guy on the left, or on the right there, Mark Leshiker, and then had recently been involved in other shootings before this picture was taken. So you're looking at a guy, although he's shaved off his beard for that photo, and dressed in his formal uniform, you know, this is a man in one of a deep, dark spiral of drugs and violence that would eventually claim his life. He's not going to survive any of this. So the guys went, those two guys that you just showed, they both had young daughters. They took them to Disney World in March 2018 for one of the girls' birthdays, and took so much drugs that Mark started wiling out and having paranoid delusions, and one thing led to another. You know, it was really getting on Billy's nerves. And this culminated with Levine, who had severe anger issues, just lost his temper and pulled out his gun and just shot Mark multiple times right in front of his daughter, right in front of both of their daughters.
So the guy who was in the formal uniform, just to clarify for people to understand, the guy in the formal uniform shot the guy who's, does he have like full arm tattoos?
Yeah, sleeve tattoos are a big thing in the special forces.
Okay, yeah. And what's fascinating about that scene, and I think it speaks to a lot of the themes in the book, is that, and it took me a while, I kept having to I started reading this on physically reading the book, and then I started listening to it, and I actually really liked it, and I realized only like at the very end that the narrator is someone who I've listened to because he narrates Bosch mysteries, like the Michael Connelly books. But anyway, I had to listen again and again because I was like, wait, am I getting this wrong? Because Levine, even though it's his friend who's wiling out, as you say, I kept thinking, like, I knew that one killed the other, and I kept thinking that it was the one wiling out who killed the other one. But really what happens, and again, we're not giving this away because this is the very beginning, but really it's the one who's less out of control, although I guess they were both out of their minds on drugs at this point, but the one who's less out of control shoots the one who's more out of control.
Yeah. Yeah. And just so folks know who haven't read the book, I mean, this is literally chapter one. Unfortunately, yeah, a lot of people get murdered in this book. And the reason I start with this one is to show how Delta Force operators have impunity to commit crimes, because after killing the guy right in his house, he was arrested and taken to the police station, but almost immediately the charges just disappeared. He gave multiple inconsistent accounts of the shooting to different people. And then claimed, finally settled on the story that Mark had attacked him with a screwdriver. But the medical examiner determined that there was no screwdriver. There was no weapon. Mark was unarmed. He had nothing in his hands when he was shot and killed. Nevertheless, the police department pretended to believe this phony story because, you know, that's who Billy Levine is. His buddies, the other operators, they showed up at the police station to collect him. You know, Levine was almost, he was indignant that they had even brought him in and questioned him, and contemptuous of the detective who interviewed him, because Levine wrote later, you know, this guy thought he was a hard ass. Like he thought he was interrogating me. This is a guy who probably has, I don't know, 8 hours of training at some shitty hotel. That's what Levine wrote about this detective. Like, because Levine, of course, was trained in in resisting interrogation. He had been extensively trained in resisting interrogation. And so he did exactly that. And as I said, was kind of offended that they'd even arrested him, because these guys had so much a sense of being above the law. And that wasn't the first, so they let him go. And the reason I start the book with that is just illustrate, look, here's an instance in which this guy just committed straight up first degree murder, and they let him go because of who he is. And then in the course of the book, he'll go on to commit many more crimes, none of which are going to result in a prosecution.
It's interesting. I was just going to ask you about the first degree murder question. Then I remembered, oh yeah, you're a lawyer as well. So, and we're going to get into your biography in a second, but I don't want to give it away, I will ask this question. And because I think maybe it does get to the issue. I mean, he didn't plan it, right? First degree requires premeditation.
Levine did not plan it. However, premeditation doesn't mean that you planned it long in advance.
Okay, it can be like within a couple seconds or something.
Premeditation simply means that you intended to do it. It doesn't matter if it was a split second. It doesn't matter if you formed that intention within. And in fact, premeditation is not often seen in actual murder statutes. Or in common law decisions, that's kind of it definitely is out there, but again, it's a synonym for intentionality.
Okay.
As used in the common law for murder. And intentionality means like you pointed the gun at someone, you pulled the trigger, you wanted them to die, as opposed to a situation where, you may have accidentally killed someone or not realized, like, let's say you hit them with a baseball bat.
I see. Right.
Assaulting them but not expecting them to die, might be a different class of murder. You might second degree murder or something.
And what about crimes of passion? Where do they fall into that? I mean, that's not a legal term, right? That's a...
No, there's no such thing. There's no justification. There were antiquated excuses in the law. For example, if a man caught another man in bed with his wife, then he could murder that man and be excused. Those were eliminated ages ago. Right. So there's no crime of passion exception.
Got it. Okay. That's interesting. I mean, it makes it somewhat different, right? Again, I'm not defending men killing anyone because they walk in on their partners sleeping with someone else. But there is perhaps I don't know. I'm just thinking now because it actually does get to kind of like the way that they're trained or not trained or whether it's an emotional response or how much the PTSD has to do with it. But I understand those don't really change. I guess those are like mitigating factors, perhaps, as opposed to things that change the degree of the murder.
I think what would really be operative in a case like this would be the sort of stand your ground laws, right, and castle doctrines. Those are
scary.
Radical interpretations of the of self-defense, which it remains an excuse for murder. If you are a justification for murder, you can kill somebody to defend yourself or to defend someone else's life. But many states have created statutes that greatly expand those and just make it a lot easier to get away with that kind of type of defense. But in this case, really, they didn't come into play because, there's just detail. There's a lot of details I haven't got into, but relevant to that point is that Mark's daughter was inside Billy's house. Billy had taken both girls inside. And so at the time he was shot, Mark was coming in the front door to get his daughter. So he didn't occupy the place of an intruder. This is getting really down in the weeds and illegal, nitty gritty. But he couldn't be described as an intruder under the circumstances.
Right.
Otherwise, Billy may have actually been able to just blow the guy away, even though he was unarmed.
Right. Well, it's interesting because there is another case that you get to with the book, which speaks to, and of course, stand your ground laws are often like very racialized. I mean, we see like time and time again, but there's another person who does do precisely that, right? Like shoot someone who's like trying to install something on his lawn.
Yeah.
But that's,
right. So yeah, that was another, we went from the first chapter of the book to the very last chapter. Kind of in closing,
impunity,
I mentioned that story to show that, you know, that happened relatively recently. A colonel in the special forces named Galen Huss, a Chechen man who was in this country legally seeking asylum and who had a visa, had a work permit, was working for an internet service provider making maps of the distribution of high-speed internet in that area in Carthage, North Carolina, one of the small towns right by Fort Bragg. And he trespassed slightly on this colonel's property, totally unarmed, didn't even have any work stuff with him. And for whatever reason, they had words, they had some kind of verbal argument. And then Colonel Huss shot him multiple times and killed him.
Including in the back, right?
I know he was shot in the hand and in the torso. I think also in the back. Yeah. I'm not sure about that. I remember I talked to the person who was murdered. His name was Ramzan Dariev. I talked to his brother who washed his body after he was killed and described washing the wounds on his hand and in his face and in his back. So this guy just unloaded on this unarmed man saying, "Oh, you trespassed on my property," you know? And the Moore County District Attorney, which is reflexively deferential to the special forces, determined that it was a case of justified homicide. So nothing has changed in like the 4 years or the 6 years that elapsed between these two murders. Like these guys will get a pass if they kill somebody on U.S. soil.
Right. And so one of the things that I really liked about the book is that it didn't, the main character, the characters are very, they're not one dimensional. But you also don't lose sight of the structural context in which they're operating, right? Because a lot of these crimes would not have been committed if there had been interventions earlier on, right? Like a lot of these crimes are later people that were killed after they attacked other people. Or there are these horrible examples we all hear about where they're, you know, people will do something to their wives and then they're not stopped and then they wind up killing their wives. But talk about the actual system, like how much the entire system is actively involved in either the smuggling itself, the taking of drugs, the murder, and the cover-up. Like how involved are the special forces as a whole involved in the scandal, and also the higher-up elites?
There's multiple layers at which you could cut it. If you cut it at the highest level of U.S. government, you could say that the White House, the State Department, the CIA, the Pentagon, and USAID all openly funded, armed, and protected the biggest drug cartel in world history in Afghanistan for 20 years and caused the entire planet to be flooded with cheap and potent heroin as a result of policy choices that were deliberately made under President Obama and under President Trump to allow this to go, and also under President George W. Bush to initially partner with all of these drug traffickers who we stood up in Afghanistan and made the government of Afghanistan out of this collection of narco warlords, and to allow them to grow poppy unimpeded, to allow it to flourish to such an extraordinary degree, to the point where there has never been a narco state on par with Afghanistan. This was explicit U.S. policy, or not explicit in the sense that it was stated, but in the sense that it was out in the open. For the most part, they never talked about it and just counted on the media to lie to you and tell you it's the Taliban that are doing it. Because that's how little they respect your intelligence. They can just tell you the opposite of the truth and expect that, you know, the New York Times and all the other leading newspapers to just simply repeat it. Although there were, from time to time, there was reporting on the complicity that U.S. clients aid, but it was always very muddled. No one ever just came out and said it, that the U.S.-backed government in Afghanistan was a giant drug cartel. I mean, look at what they're trying to say now about Maduro in Venezuela.
An
absolute joke for them to say that that's what they call a cartel. Venezuela, this country that produces virtually no drugs, that has tons and tons of oil, but is not a drug producing country. And there's almost no evidence that Maduro or his government are involved in, except the statement of a paid DEA informant and some other crappy low level intelligence that they throw out. I mean, contrast that with what was going on in Afghanistan for 20 years, where Ahmed Wali Karzai, the president's brother, half brother, literally controlling the biggest opium market in the entire world in Kandahar, just all of the drugs that were produced in the Helmand Valley going through there, all the money traceable easily to Hamid Karzai's government, drug flows from Dubai and stuff. We knew all of this. It was all out in the open. So these are not serious people, or the people who claim that Maduro is a cartel or the leader of a cartel. You know, these are not serious people. These are just propagandists. Right. And for the most part, they don't have a good grasp of the facts and also are ignorant of the ways that the world actually works. So that's one thing, you know, but if you cut it in the sort of one thing I never allege is that the special forces as a military organization is dedicated to trafficking narcotics around the world. That's not happening.
Right.
And that wouldn't even make any sense. Why would they be doing that? People traffic drugs to make money. And what are the special forces don't need any money. They get all the money that they want from the government. But then if you cut it at a third and lowest level, at the level of enlisted operators in units like Delta Force or in the Green Berets, it is definitely a thing. Trafficking drugs is definitely a thing among those guys. How many of them are involved in it, it's hard to say, but I document case after case in my book, enough where I can say that, you know, again, this is a thing that a lot of these guys do.
So we're going to get into Venezuela because it's very relevant, obviously, to what's happening right now. Also, you just mentioned Afghanistan, and, you know, it's such an amazing contrast. And I think it's kind of like a controlled experiment to see the way that the U.S. Reacts to Afghanistan versus Venezuela. It makes it very clear it's not about drug production. But you talk about the drug trade in Afghanistan and the involvement of the Delta team and other forces. You say the Afghan client state had functioned as the world's biggest drug cartel, responsible for producing at least 4/5 and more like 9/10 of all the heroin consumed during the global opioid epidemic. facing a certain wipeout by advancing Taliban, the infamous NATO protectorate, which was also deeply inculpated in child sex trafficking and roundly despised by the Afghan people, fell to pieces and dispersed. So can you elaborate on that, please?
I mean, I didn't even have time to get into the child sex trafficking in the book, but that's almost worse in some ways. Like this is another thing that was openly tolerated by the United States. And it's even worse than allowing them to pump heroin into our country and all over the world. You know, the bachabazi is what it's called, or boy play. Another thing that we're falsely told is like just part of Afghan culture. It's not. And the Taliban, importantly, are totally opposed to this. And in fact, the Taliban's popularity in the 1990s first derived from the fact that they suppressed this practice, which as far as I can tell, has no long-term basis in Afghanistan. I've read accounts from Afghan journalists who know what they're talking about, who say this is not part of our culture. What it is closely identified with are the warlords that the CIA funded and armed in the 1980s to fight the Soviet Union. Those guys were the ones who first made it a thing to collect prepubescent dancing boys, trade them with other men, and systematically rape them and keep them on their bases in chains, these children. And they continued to do this during the entirety of the U.S. occupation, when they were getting all their money, all their weapons from the United States, their political protection from the United States, air support from the United States, keeping child sex slaves on the bases created by this military partnership with the United States. And the U.S. knew about it the entire time. And not only did nothing to stop it, but also explicitly ordered U.S. forces to not interfere in the rape of children that took place on U.S. bases. There's a seminal New York Times article about Captain, I believe his last name, I don't want to get it wrong, so I won't say it. He's a special forces captain who came across a police commander with a little prepubescent boy, you know, a child chained to his bed. And was so outraged by this that he beat the stuffing out of this Afghan commander. He was relieved of duty and discharged from the military and disciplined. And it is, again, specific U.S. policy communicated from the command. There's also a documentary, maybe DW, I think, documentary on this that interviews lots of NATO officers who all attest to this appalling fact that the U.S. military specifically ordered troops to turn a blind eye to the rape of children carried out by their Afghan allies on U.S. bases. And 1 month before the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan, the State Department finally issued a report saying, oh yeah, we're against this. We don't like this. This is bad. So I only devote like two sentences to that right in my book, but this is another topic that, yeah, bears investigation.
So a soldier was punished for killing the person who had the child chained to his bed.
He didn't kill him. He beat him severely.
Oh, for beating him up. Right, beating him up. Yeah. But nothing was done to the person who had the child chained to his bed?
No, that commander, I'm not sure what became of him, but I believe that he remained an important U.S. ally. You know, he was a DW goes and interviews this guy. These are not only narcos. This is why I have to only ridicule these claims about Maduro, because right, the Afghans we worked with were not only big time narcos, but they were rapists in this sense. So DW interviewed, I believe it was the same people around the same commander, and they even had an audience with, I believe it was the same commander. If it wasn't the same one, it doesn't really matter too much because they're similar in this regard. But the guy's making jokes and laughing about it, you know, taking drug, doing opium, smoking opium right in front of the camera crew. This is the democracy that we created in Afghanistan at a cost to U.S. taxpayers, I might add, of $1 trillion.
So explain why the West was so intent on not disrupting, basically. I'm not saying that they were like part of this child rape ring. I'm not saying that. But why did they not do something about it? Why did they so systemically turn a blind eye to it? And is that a fair way of describing it?
Mm-hmm. For the same reason that they turned a blind eye to all the drugs. they had invested their political capital in this war, which, by the way, the reporting around this is so disingenuous that it almost makes me angry. I recently read a book by John Lee Anderson, who on Afghanistan on the 20th is called, The Fall and Rise of the Taliban. To Lose a War, The Rise and Fall of the Taliban. And he writes at the beginning of the book that the Taliban refused to turn over Osama bin Laden after 9/11. That's what precipitated the war. Now, I don't know John Lee Anderson, but I know for a fact that he knows damn well that the Taliban offered to turn over Osama bin Laden to a third country for processing judicially by the United States, and that they just used this weaselly terminology, even 20 years later, still lying about it because the mistake was so, consequential that they decided to not only go to war with Osama bin Laden, but also to go to war with the Taliban and treat the Taliban, which is totally different, is not a terrorist organization, to treat them as the same as Al-Qaeda and to double down on that decision year after year for 20 years. And none of them had the political courage to backtrack, even though they kept losing more and more ground because the allies that they were able to get were bad people that the Afghan people hated. You can tell them, we're doing this for your good. We're doing this because you need to let girls go to school. We're doing this for democracy. But they just weren't up for that. You can't control other countries' destinies like that. And all they could do was just keep this puppet government in place and tolerate all its abuses, no matter how putrid they became.
Yeah, that was something that was really shocking to me. I mean, it's not that you're writing a manifesto in defense of the Taliban, but, you know, I knew that the U.S. allies in Afghanistan who replaced the Taliban were corrupt. I knew there was tons of corruption. I knew there was drugs. I didn't know about this other element about it, though. Basically, the child rape trafficking. This may get demonetized, but I don't care. I mean, it's more obviously... I mean, speaking of corruption, it's more important to talk about this than to be able to make something off of YouTube from this. But yeah, that was just disgusting. And it really is. I mean, it speaks to the rank hypocrisy. In fact, we should just contrast this with what is happening in Venezuela. And we're going to show a video in a second. But watching what is done to in Afghanistan versus Venezuela is really disgusting. So at one point in the book, you comment on the wildly fluctuating and conjectural nature of intelligence assessments on the topic of narco-terrorism, as admitted in a 2018 retrospective on the operations against narcotics in Afghanistan. So this made me think of Marco Rubio from a press conference given in Mexico City earlier this month on September 3rd, defending the bombing of the alleged, without any proof given, alleged drug boat from Venezuela in the South Caribbean. Let's hear what Rubio had to say.
Our narco-terrorist organizations, this one was operating in international waters, headed towards the United States to flood our country with poison. And under President Trump, those days are over.
So what's your response to that?
He's just lying. There's no evidence of that. Why do you have a boat that size with one outboard motor and 11 guys to move drugs from the coast of Venezuela to the United States? That's literally impossible. You cannot cross the Caribbean in a boat that size. And if you the type of craft that they use for those type of smuggling, they either have it secreted aboard, ocean liners and cargo containers. And if they have dedicated, drug craft, they're typically submersible submarines. They real cartels like they have in Colombia are a lot more sophisticated than that. There is no evidence. They're just saying, take our word for it. But why should we believe anything that these liars say? Look, everything that they say is a lie. Everything they say about Israel is a lie. You know, everything the Trump administration says, these are not credible people. Who cares what Marco Rubio says to justify this act of terrorism, this thing that they did for people to see on TV? Look, we just murdered 11 people for you to watch on TV. And they're drug traffickers, trust us. Again, what is the evidence for that? And even if there were evidence for it, even if they were proved to be drug traffickers, like let's say they have these guys on a cell phone intercept saying, meet us here, we're going to take the drugs there, which we haven't seen, but assuming that they had that and they could release it, you don't get to kill people for trafficking drugs. That's a violation of the laws of war. And I know these people on the right and the people in Trump's camp, like that ship sailed for them a long time ago. They don't care at all about the laws of war, but a lot of people still do. And people still will care in the future. And I still do. And a lot of people in this country still do. And the laws of war say, yes, you can attack enemy soldiers who are coming to kill you. If you're in a war with the other side and those guys are combatants, you can legally kill them. But that does not apply to criminals who are trying to smuggle drugs. You may say those are bad people.
Sure.
You may say that they need to be arrested and put in prison.
Right.
You can talk about whatever harsh punishments you want, but just bombing them is a violation of the laws of war. And these simpletons on who are lapping this up, these lies and believing it, they can just disregard that all they want. But, you know, the rest of the world will hold firm. And we will get past that, this, and God willing, one day bring these people to justice, bring people like Marco Rubio to justice, terrorists like Marco Rubio.
Yeah. And terrorists like J.D. Vance, who's defending this and praising this and celebrating this. I mean, just unbelievable.
Those people should be tried for war crimes and punished accordingly, because it is serious business when you are killing people with your military in a way that's completely outside the rules and strictures that the countries and armies have observed, you know, granted, not in a consistent way, but by and large, most of the time that they have observed throughout history.
Right.
And these people are beyond the pale. And again, they need to be held responsible.
Right. And these aren't simpletons. I mean, these are smart, evil people, Rubio and J.D. Vance. They're manipulating simpletons, right?
No, I think that they, I don't think that they're stupid people, but I just think that they're bad people. Really?
Yeah, they're evil. They're awful people. Yeah.
Say anything and who believe in nothing.
Yeah.
And it's actually horrifying to behold the countenance of someone like Marco Rubio, someone that lost to human decency.
Right.
But, you know, he's a gusano. He comes from that Cuban exile community, speaking of drug dealers. And look at where he grew up, by the way, and the people that were around him. He wants to talk about drug trafficking. Let's look at some of his Cuban compatriots that fought against the revolution of Fidel Castro and what they got, the terrorism and drug trafficking that they got into. And again, look where Marco Rubio lived when he was a kid, drug houses where he was raised.
Right. Tell us more about that. The drug houses where he was raised.
I really don't have the details at my fingertips.
We'll have we'll do another show on it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you know what I'm talking about. I've seen reporting around this. It's the whole Miami thing, that Cuban exiles. Well, I can tell you for a fact, we can talk at length about how Cuban exiles, opposed to Fidel Castro, did tons of drug trafficking back in the day.
Yeah.
And as well as terrorism for the CIA.
Right. Yeah.
Things are a lot more degraded since then. We have these people in charge now.
Right. And, you know, just to remind people, in case people missed it, I mean, this was just beyond the pale. J.D. Vance said, killing cartel members who poison our fellow citizens is the highest and best use of our military. So.
Easy for a guy who is a PAO in the Marine Corps. J.D. Vance was a public affairs officer in the Marine Corps. He has never heard a shot fired in anger, to my knowledge. He is a soft man with soft hands who talks hard, but he's not. And I just pray that these words of his come back to haunt him, these flagrant statements of defiance for, again, the laws of war and the way that civilized countries conduct themselves. I really hope that they come back to haunt him in a really real way.
Yeah, that would be justice. Well, let's take a look at something that Nicolas Maduro said during an interview, talking about the true drug money kingpin around the world. Let's hear who he says that is. 85% of the billions from international drug trafficking each year is in banks in the United States. That's where the cartel is. Let them investigate and uncover it. Money laundering. Money laundering. Look, I was reviewing the data the vice president shared, and I believe it's over $500 billion annually. That's in the U.S. banking system, in legal banks. If they want to investigate a cartel, let them investigate the cartel up north, because it's from the United States that all drug trafficking is directed, from South America and from the rest of the world. They also control the opium trade and so on. It's in the United States where the mafias are, where the real cartels are. So what's your response to that?
I mean, we know that that banks in the United States launder cartel money. And if they ever get caught, which is rare, pay minuscule fines. You know, there was the case HSBC, which is laundering the Sinaloa cartel's money. But, you know, that's to say nothing of the fact that drug demand is in the United States. So you don't even have to talk about, you know, the money ending up in this country too, because it's drug consumers in the United States that are causing all of this. And people want to point fingers at South America or at Mexico. It's because they don't have the courage or the strength to look at our own country and our own culture, which consumes drugs in such abundance. They say, they're infiltrating drugs into our country to poison our kids. No, they're not. They are selling to willing buyers, to people who will pay high prices for this stuff and are looking all over the place for someone to supply them. Drugs are not, the drug market is not a collection of organizations. Drug cartels, for the most part, are illusory. It's rare that you see a comprehensive sort of top-down organization like the one that existed in Afghanistan for 20 years. That's the closest thing to a real cartel, because the cartel in economic sense is one that controls prices. So the Karzai cartel that was later run by Ashraf Ghani with full U.S. support in Afghanistan, that kind of was a real cartel because you had one or two guys at the top and they definitely determined the world price of heroin. I mean, they were producing virtually all of the heroin in the world. Elsewhere in Mexico and Central America, you know, you may hear this phrase more and more thanks to the work of Osvaldo Zavala, but drug cartels do not exist. The idea of drug cartels in Mexico, that's a media creation for the most part. These are markets. They're not organizations. So you have the demand component of it comes entirely from the United States. We have the highest rate of drug use of any country in the world. And we want drugs and we're willing to pay for them. And so people in other countries step up to fill that void. In other countries that are not as developed, because it's easier to break the law in those countries. So we're procuring their production, which is being done in a very disorganized and low-level way by many, many actors, some competing, some cooperating, to fill this supply. And that's coming from Mexico, and it's coming from Colombia and Peru and Ecuador. By the way, the U.S. totally backs a drug, or, you know, a government in Ecuador that's deeply involved in the drug drug trafficking industry, much more so than Venezuela. I mean, the hypocrisy here, again, it's not even hypocrisy. It's just when you hear Marco Rubio talking, it's like he realizes the people that he's talking to have no information about the world. Like they really just have no information about. They don't know the difference between Ecuador and Venezuela. They don't know that Venezuela's low-lying and the coca grows in the mountains. You can just lie to them and tell them, oh yeah, it's a drug country. But that aside, you know, for the most part, this is all happening organically. This is not being directed by top-down organizations. Drugs are just one of many illegal businesses in the world. And one of many ways that marginal people that are able to make profits, you know, people on the margins of the formal economy is what I mean. They're able to profit from this type of activity. But it's not the only one, you know. So there's a criminal element certainly in all these countries, but they're not organized in the form of a cartel with a boss wearing a big cowboy hat and ostrich boots, sitting at the head of the table, trying to decide who's going to become his successor, with all these, like, you know, Byzantine intrigues between them, as we see portrayed in movies like Sicario or in TV shows like Narcos. That shit doesn't exist. That's not real. Yeah. That's just for US consumers to imagine that they're being victimized by these criminal organizations when, again, the demand comes from this country. And the only way to eliminate it would be to eliminate demand in this country.
Right. And we'll have to do, it's so painful having you on, Seth, because I could do like an 8-hour interview with you, because I want to be like, okay, how do we eliminate demand? Like, no, I got to stay focused. But that is a really important question. One that we can get to on another, maybe later on this interview, we'll see where it goes. But I have to go back. I'm sorry to go back to J.D. Vance, because I realized I didn't do my full, I'd be remiss if I didn't show the entire exchange that he had with someone. I have to say, this is someone I do not usually respect, but, you know, politics makes strange bedfellows. And there are times when libs and I will agree on things. So here's J.D. Vance, returning to what he said, because I didn't give the full quote. Killing cartel members who poison our fellow citizens is the highest and best use of our military. Then Brian Krasenstein responds, killing the citizens of another nation who are civilians without any due process is called a war crime. And then he says, I don't give a shit what you call it. So that's our vice president, who went to Yale Law School, I believe, and was also in the military himself.
Well, he's a disgrace to all of the foregoing. He's a disgrace to his office. He's a disgrace to our country. He's a disgrace to Yale Law School, and he's a disgrace to his family, because he's talking about murdering unarmed people. And the measure of a country is how it treats criminals and the most vulnerable among them, because it's easy to get the mob angry enough to kill criminals. But powerful countries, you know, civilized countries are able to have due process of law, where even the worst people get their day in court and get to have that. I mean, that's strength. And what he is doing is just demagoguery of the most, basic sort.
I mean, how do you compare Biden and Trump when it comes to, I guess, when it comes to Israel and Gaza, but also more generally, I guess, when as it comes to foreign policy?
It's like asking me to compare the smell of cat poop versus dog poop. They differ. But I can't say that one is worse than the other. Both are really, really horrible.
If you're here live, you're in so much luck, because you got to see that whole amazing interview with Seth. If you're watching this later and you want to see the full interview with Seth, then you can find the rest of it at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. And again, the Patreon is how this show functions. We literally could not do this show without your Patreon support. And so you can support us there for $5 a month. You get extra content, bonus content, extended interviews, early release interviews. For $1 a month, you just get to sleep well knowing that you're contributing to a show that tells you things that you won't hear at the corporate on corporate media. And also give it a like. That's a really easy way to support the show. We are going to be bringing on to the stage, the virtual stage, Hadika Arzumalik, who is a 21-year-old organizer, student, poet, and student leader of the Tamkeen movement, which aims to uplift the Muslim community through education and social organization. She's a double major in political science and international relations and minors in human rights. And she was recently suspended from CUNY City College for pro-Palestine activism. We're also going to be joined by her partner in crime, in some ways, Dr. Corinna Mullen, who is an anti-imperialist academic who was recently fired from her job as adjunct faculty at the City University of New York for her Palestine solidarity work. Corinna is a member of the Anti-Imperialist Scholars Collective, a delegate in the PSC CUNY Delegate Assembly, and serves on the steering committee of the PSC CUNY's International Committee. She organizes with CUNY for Palestine and Labor for Palestine, and is an associate editor for Middle East Critique and Science and Society. So welcome, Corinna and Hadika.
Hi, thanks so much for having us.
Before we get into the story about what's happening to you guys, tell us both about your trajectory and how you became, you know, pro-Palestine, anti-genocide organizers and activists. Hadika, you want to go first?
Okay, I'll go first. Hi, my name is Hadika, and I think that as a human, you know, I've always had a sense of calling to justice, to activism. I mean, it started in high school, I think, especially during the first Trump presidency. It kind of woke a lot of people up, but there was like levels to waking up. I feel like we're all still waking up every single day to more and more of the lies that we've been taught. And then even more so post October 7th with the genocide in the Gaza, I think it's just woken myself along with so many others in my generation, in the world, to the atrocities of colonization in live time through the genocide of Gaza and the ongoing occupation of Palestine. And so I started college at CUNY about 3 years ago, and I joined Students for Justice in Palestine, all giddy and excited. And yeah, I think from there, the rest was history. Just got more and more involved and met amazing people like Dr. Mullen, who have really just taught me so much and shown me the ropes and made me realize how much beauty is in collective resistance and struggle on our campuses. And, you know, to this day, the struggle continues and the fight keeps going, and I'm still in it, even if they try to boot me out.
Yeah, thanks for that, Hadika. I was lucky as a kid to you know, to have some incredible parents who were themselves organizers from the 60s, and even going further back, you know, my grandparents from my both parents' side were part of the Communist Party here, you know, Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. And we're quite radical in their own ways. And then my parents as well, my mom in particular, who was very involved in supporting the Palestinian liberation struggle. She was an anti-Zionist and, you know, and educated us well as kids. And then, of course, in college and doing my PhD, that was at the time of the Iraq War. I got really involved in anti-imperialist organizing and Palestine sort of, you know, being at the core of anti-imperialism was, you know, a necessary sort of trajectory and getting involved in support and solidarity for Palestine liberation. And then I joined CUNY in 2017. I became the faculty advisor for the SJP at John Jay, which was my principal university or campus where I taught. I also then later joined Brooklyn College. But all I would say is what Hadika said, I would say the reverse. We learned, you know, the faculty learned so much from student organizers, and, you know, as academic workers, because the students, my entire time at CUNY, have just been at the forefront in fighting for, you know, in solidarity with Palestinian liberation, fighting to divest our institution from settler colonialism and genocide. They've been fearless in protesting, you know, statements, organizing across New York, not just on campus. And so it's their courage and their fearlessness and people, you know, student organizers and leaders like Hadika that have inspired and pushed us to do more.
Right. So, both of you have very inspiring stories. Tell us a little bit in your own words about what you were doing and what kind of trouble, good trouble, you got into, what the consequences you're facing right now are.
Right. Well, where do I begin? Most recently, I was fired. I'm one of the four adjuncts fired from Brooklyn College. We haven't been given any reason by the administration. And, you know, they're not obliged to, because as adjuncts, we have very weak contractual protections, structurally precarious in our labor. Our contracts say that we can be fired for any reason or no reason at all. And I think, you know, the administration, you know, thinks it's being clever by not giving us the reasons so that, you know, they can't be held accountable for violating our constitutional protections. And yeah.
Which is, by the way, a great example, right? I mean, people talk about this a lot, how Palestine is not just Palestine is an issue. It's a climate issue. It's a gender issue. And it's a labor issue. I mean, this is a really clear case of that, right?
Absolutely. It's a labor issue for all kinds of reasons. You know, one of the areas of organizing I do as well is with Labor for Palestine. And, you know, of course, now we've been focusing a lot on the issue of repression, retaliation, measures taken against workers who stand out and, you know, and speak out in solidarity with Palestine. But on the other hand, it's a labor issue because, you know, we can use our labor power to stop the genocide. And increasingly workers are doing that, you know, attempting to shut down supply chains, delivering weapons to Israel through, you know, trying to get our institutions, our places of employment, or even our unions, our pension funds to divest from settler colonial genocide, imperialist warfare. So absolutely. And Palestine, all the various issues coalesce around Palestine, also in connection to racist policing, the carceral state, a military industrial complex. So yeah, absolutely.
I hope this doesn't get to your head, but you were recently, I think this is very flattering for anyone on the left, but you were featured in none other than the wonderful New York Post. Let's take a look here. Anti-Israel professor who allegedly helped organize vile CUNY protests must be probed, New York City polls demand. An Israel-hating CUNY professor allegedly helped organize a vile campus protest that resulted in $3 million in damage, a pair of city council members alleged. Council members Ina Vernikov, Republican of Brooklyn, and Kalman Yeager, Democrat of Brooklyn, are calling for an investigation and potentially the professor's firing. They claim they have credible information. Adjunct political science professor Karina Mullen was among the ringleaders of the April encampment at the City College of New York's Harlem campus. This is back from November 24th, but I just wanted to give everyone a chance to see that you've really made it, because you've incurred the ire, not just of the New York Post, but also of Ina Vernikov. And she herself should get a lot of credit because she, but tell us about her and tell us about this campaign against you while I get these pictures ready.
Yeah, she's a total, I mean, she's a caricature of herself. I mean, really, fascist, right-wing politician who showed up at a CUNY protest at Brooklyn College with a gun, and just makes a career out of going after people who are standing up for social justice issues, and especially Palestine. She's gone after so many of our organizers at CUNY, including people like Nordin Kiswani and Fatima Mohammed. I wear it as a badge of honor. There she is with that gun. And you know what? I should mention here that the president of Brooklyn College, Michelle Anderson, still to this day has never said a word about this, didn't condemn it, hasn't mentioned it. It's ridiculous because she put students, we're joking about it, but, it's scary. She put students' lives at risk. And, the fact that our administration said nothing about it is so telling about where their interests lie and whose interests they protect. The ruling class interests, not the interests of its predominantly Black and brown working class students and faculty.
Right. Also, she doesn't just rock a gun occasionally. She also likes to rock a very elegant, glamorous, according to Fox News, Israel flag dress. Here she is.
I know.
Trigger warning, pretty hideous on all levels. Horrific. But yeah, there you have
it. In the middle of a genocide. Horrific.
Right. Yeah. So Hadika, tell us what happened to you, what you did, did in quotes, why you got into this good trouble.
Yeah. So I have been the president of Students for Justice in Palestine's chapter at City College for a while now. And I think, honestly, the targeting started from there. The second I joined the club, it was always the most surveilled and the most targeted on campus. And then when the CUNY Gaza Solidarity encampments happened last year, the militarization and the surveillance increased exponentially. Honestly, there was not a single day on campus within the past year in which I was not intensely watched or followed on campus by public safety, by even Zionists that would try to intimidate me on campus. And so I think that was like the context, is that like this has been ongoing targeting and situation, but they got you know, all of these accusations exactly where they wanted on February 27th, 2025. So we had a protest because the governor of New York came to City College, thought that she could come to City College. Actually, she didn't come to City College because we ended up, you know, our protest ended up deterring her from coming to the event that she was going to put on. And so we made it loud and clear that war criminals are not welcomed on our campus, because prior to that day, she had just removed the Palestinian studies job listing for professors at Hunter College that same month. And this was on top of her threatening all New York State.
It's what a disgusting coward.
So pathetic. And her threatening all New York State college and university presidents that if they don't crack down on student protests for Palestine, then she would start removing financial aid and funding for those very students in the very schools. And so we were loud and clear about the fact that she was not welcomed on our campus. And so we held a protest, and CUNY has weaponized and created, honestly, these bogus policies called the Henderson Rules, which they're calling their sort of neutral code of conduct policies that they keep for students on campus to sort of maintain public order. But they've been only used and created as a means of repression and repressing student movements. And so I was specifically accused and suspended on the basis of violating Henderson Rules 1 and 7. And number one was the fact that I was, you know, not willing to allow students to comfortably in silence be able to go to class and go to school while we're learning and Gaza is burning. And so the claim exactly was that I was a, you know, a threat to campus life, and I was infringing on the rights of other students to their education. While every single university in Gaza has been destroyed, not a single one has been left to stand, while CUNY has funded the destruction of every single one of those universities. And Henderson Rule number 7 that they claimed I violated was, you know, a sense of disrespect and not maintaining a code of conduct on campus. And so they specifically made it a point to mention that I was really disrespectful and targeted a Muslim police officer for his name being Muhammad, basically alluding to the fact that they're calling me Islamophobic, which is the funniest and craziest.
Self-loathing. Maybe you're self-loathing.
It's absurd. there was course, a video that had gone a little viral, but it was in a moment of time in which, you know, the NYPD, one of their tactics that they use, one of many repressive tactics, is they go straight for the hijabs. For sisters on the front lines of protests, they are intentional about ripping off hijabs at these protests in their brutality. And another thing that they do, I think, especially after 2020, when they lost a lot of their publicity and got a lot of bad PR, they have felt the need to put Black and brown police officers at the front lines of these protests, right, to make us think that if a Black or brown person is repressing us, it's any bit better than if a white police officer were to do the same, as if that makes a difference to us. And so in a moment of time in which we're at this protest and there's a line of cops lined up to repress our movement, to stand there and intimidate our movement and also try to sort of like fragment our movement and bottle kettle us. On one side of our protest, we had the entire Muslim Student Association leadership sort of arrested on one side. And on the other side, you have a Palestinian hijabi woman who is, you know, upon police orders, actually moving from the street to the sidewalk. And as she does so, a Muslim police officer out of everybody in that line of cops whips out his baton and threatens to hit her with it while also simultaneously looking like he's going for the hijab. In this moment, I, as a Muslim, am very, very frustrated at the situation. And so, you know, in this moment, I did a mic check. We called out the hypocrisy in this moment and the fact that somebody who can wear a badge along the names of Muhammad or Abdurrahman or Abdullah cannot be walking around acting in such a disgusting manner and functioning within a system that's literally the arm of the oppressor. And so I said, put some respect on that name. And that ended up being one of the means in which I was suspended because I was apparently Islamophobic for that.
So amazing.
And
right.
Then the two CCNY demonstration policies that I allegedly violated were not getting a permit to protest, which if you get a permit to protest, it's not a protest anymore. It's just their means of trying to control and have a sense of authority over free speech on campus, which goes into the second rule that I allegedly violated, which was that I didn't stay in the little pig pen that they created that they call their freedom of speech zone, which in itself is crazy because if you have a free speech corner, what does that mean the rest of the campus?
Right.
I don't know.
Exactly. Right. It's a free speech free campus.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's also really important to note that these were policies and rules that we had never been a thing before prior to them doing this in the middle of June. You know, they're really clearly showing the escalation in their repression and how they're creating things as they go to see how far that they can sort of push the line of repression to see how much that they can get away with. And so that's why Karina and I and the rest of the students or faculty that have been affected by the repression at CUNY have been making it such a big point to launch campaigns to call out CUNY's repression at every given moment that we can, because this is exactly how they intend to get away with killing over 400,000 Palestinians in Gaza in broad daylight. And we cannot let that happen.
It's so disturbing. It's so not funny, but it's like, what a joke. I mean, what a total weaponization of identity politics and what a weaponization of like identity. And as if, you know, they're being so sensitive to people's feelings, while, as you pointed out, you know, they care about the feelings of people who defend genocide. They care about the feelings of someone who is, you know, raising a baton. They don't care about, it's always like, right. So they care about Jewish safety. Well, not of the Jewish students who are themselves getting arrested because they oppose genocide. It's the Jewish students who are defending genocide, right? They care about Islamophobia, not when it's directed at people who are anti-genocide, but when it's directed at someone who's, you know, an armed arm of the state, which is enabling this genocide. So the double standards and the hypocrisy are just so disgusting. But I actually wanted to show some videos that you guys shared with us so people can see what happened and what was happening. So you can, we'll play them. And then if you want me to pause at any point, just raise your finger and also you can set them up.
We are the students too. We want stop fighting free. We want divestment now. We are the students too.
So you're saying, one, we are the students. Two, we won't stop fighting. Three, we want divestment now. Such scary, violent words.
I know, terrifying, right? And you saw there was the banner with the five demands that came out of the Gaza Solidarity Encampment that Hadika was discussing earlier. And that includes divestment, that includes demilitarization of the campus, because we know it's not just the NYPD that brutalize our students who are majority working class, Black and brown, but it's also the public safety officers. There should be no reason that public safety officers have things like pepper spray or guns or tasers. And we call for solidarity with the Palestinian liberation struggle. We call for a free CUNY. And the students also really centered and made a point of talking about the faculty contracts as well, the staff and faculty contracts, because we were in the process of bargaining at the time of the encampment. And that labor student solidarity was so amazing and strong. So, yeah, those demands are still there and they're part of the organizing ecosystem of CUNY. That the video you just showed was from Brooklyn College in a protest that took place there on May 8th and resulted again in this horrific level of violence that Hadika described. Rather than come down and negotiate or talk to the students, hear what their demands, these courageous and brilliant students who are talking about a genocide almost 2 years into a genocide, hundreds of thousands of people killed, as Hadika said, every single university destroyed, hospitals, infrastructure, agricultural land. And our university is complicit because of its investments and its contracts. And these students care so passionately about it that they're willing to risk, you know, being suspended, being disciplined, maybe even being deported, being arrested. We have one student in jail still, a CUNY student, Tarek Barzouk, who's been in jail in MDC for 5 months, and we're asking for him to be released. We also had many students, community members, CUNY community members who participated in the encampment, the CUNY 28, who were facing very heavy felony charges. And still today, you know, the repression continues. And now the sad thing is that we've got used to this. Like you said, you know, oh, how scary. A bunch of students on the quad, not even blocking any entrance. And how does that become a threat? All they're asking is to talk to the administration. Come and listen to them. Why is it normal now to see, you know, tens, hundreds of cops coming onto our campuses? Why is it normal for a student? We had a CUNY law student who was tasered after that protest. They forced the students off the campus onto the street so they'd be under the purview of the NYPD, the notoriously brutal SRG. You know, how is that? What kind of a world are we living in? But we shouldn't be surprised, right? Because genocide is happening. When you normalize genocide, you know, as Emile Césaire said, this is the boomerang. And it doesn't even have to be the boomerang. This country has always been fascist as a settler colonial state built on slavery and imperialism. So, you know, but this moment is heightened, and the genocide has normalized it. And so, you know, this is where we are.
Yeah. And we have some more videos. I thought we could just show some more stuff and then, like, we can, you know, go back and forth between some videos and more commentary, because that was great what you guys, both of you said. So, oh, look at that. That's RT Washington right there. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah. That is disgusting.
That's such a powerful chant. 400,000 dead, and you're arresting us instead.
Okay. So set this one up. What's happening here?
So this is from the CUNY Gaza Solidarity Encampment when a public safety pig wandered his way into our encampment. Even though we had negotiated the rules and parameters with the president of the college that not a single one would enter into our grounds, and it was agreed upon. And then our people collectively banded together to make sure that we pushed him out. And we had, you know, in mass, pushed out this entire line of public safety officers. Wow. And in the purple sweatshirt, we have Vincent Boudreau, who's the president of City College, the sellout hypocrite of City College, who's here trying to sort of de-escalate the situation. And our people continue to remain steadfast, chanting. What are we chanting here?
We will not stop.
Disclosed, divest.
Oh, we will not stop. We will not rest. Right.
And then it goes into the people united. Right. Well, now we'll be defeated.
That was a beautiful moment.
Wow. Yeah.
And that was also such a good contrast of videos too, because in that first one at Brooklyn College, it was all the brutality, and something that wasn't depicted in that moment that has always stayed with me is the fact that within minutes of that video from Brooklyn College, a public safety police car had run over a couple of CUNY students who were protesting as well. And it was really...
How was that not all over the news? I mean, I follow this. I didn't hear about that.
I don't know. They weren't on the Katie Halper show, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, that's just crazy that wasn't... I mean, I'm embarrassed. I can't believe I didn't... I can believe it, though. But I mean,
I think it's
one heard about it if we haven't heard about it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's just a reflection of how low and how dehumanized Black and brown bodies are treated in this society. But then when you see, you know, in contrast to that, the second video of how, you know, collective struggle and power can actually end up doing exactly that, which is cultivating power and fighting back this very system, it's really refreshing. You know, we see a lot of these videos, and it can get really hopeless at times and create a sense of despair. So always making sure that we're reminding ourselves of that power and that strength that we do hold as people and people united. It's always a great push to keep going and keep moving, because the people of Gaza, they don't have a choice. They have shown us what resilience looks like, and they continue to keep going. And so we have no excuse not to, especially when we have the unity and the collective numbers like we do in this moment.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's really, it reminds me that what you just mentioned about someone, a CUNY person being run over by a public safety person. Like, I mean, I don't even know if you guys know about this because it got such little coverage, but there was a guy who ran through a crowd of a Zionist guy who just ran through a crowd. No one was killed, but he ran his car through a crowd of protesters. And can you imagine the wall-to-wall coverage if it had been the reverse, if someone who was pro-Palestine had run their car into a crowd of Zionist protesters, Israel supporters? I mean, it would have been Dana Bash, Jake Tapper, Wolf Blitzer, the president, all would have been condemning it. Instead, it was not even newsworthy, according to our media, and certainly not commentary. You know, there were no congressional hearings about it. And we have one more thing to show. Oh, this is funny. This is like something that the New York Post thinks is really bad, right? This was something that the CUNY faculty did to show their support of for Palestine, right? And their opposition to genocide.
We're CUNY faculty. Of course we support the five demands.
We're CUNY faculty. Of course we know anti-Zionism is an anti-Semitism.
We're CUNY faculty. Of course we support the liberation of Palestine.
Okay, now listen to this scary music. I'll read what it says. New video posted to TikTok shows faculty members from the state-funded City University of New York expressing their support for the anti-Israel protests at City College. Look how evil he looks. The participants in the video posted on the TikTok account Left Voice all appear to be speaking from the encampment on City College's Harlem campus. And there you have the five demands listed. The encampment is one of the several campus protests that emerged across the country in response to the tent protests at Columbia University in Morningside Heights. Anti-Israel protesters have also swarmed campuses of schools like UPenn. By the way, imagine if they said pro-Israel students swarmed. I mean, right away, people would be accused of anti-Semitism. With many universities, including NYC's Columbia, being forced to call on police to restore order. I love that. They were forced. At Emory University, an economics professor was caught on CNN video being wrestled to the ground and handcuffed by police as dozens of anti-Israel demonstrators clashed with law enforcement. This is so weird. Like, are they that dumb that they don't realize that they're showing something that shows the righteous, just person who's being attacked is on the side of Gaza, not on the side of Israel? Like,
yeah, they are.
And this has scary music, and it should have scary music, but it's the opposite of it's like a piece of broken propaganda. Remember that woman? I mean, she was,
horrible.
And I believe that she actually, if I remember correctly, I don't even know if she herself was protesting, but she saw a student being attacked. She's told the officer to stop attacking the student, and that's what they did to a professor. So you can just imagine what they do to, that's what they do to a white professor. So you can imagine how it goes down the various, levels of dehumanized people. What is happening now? What can we do to support you guys? What are you guys doing? Please tell us what we can do.
I just wanted to say one thing and before we get there, Katie, regards to what you said about the video. And I think, it also really exposes the level of desperation, right now, the fascist response, whether it's here, but also the genocide itself, the imperialist invasions in Iran, what we saw today, the targeting of Hamas officials who were there as part of the ceasefire negotiations in Qatar, the targeting of the Samud, global Samud,
Flotilla.
Freedom Flotilla in Tunis. Yeah. You know, all of this. Well, this is coming from desperation. You know, this, you know, empire is in decline. U.S. empire is in decline, and so these are, you know, as Gramsci said, you know, this is the moment of monsters, right? This is the moment in between the dying of the old world order and the emergence of a new world order. And this is also, you know, obviously it's a different scale, but this is what we see at the universities as well. And across the country, you know, that this fascist response, the repression of students, this excessive use of violence and force. Of course, it's not new. You know, CUNY, there's a whole history of this, and not just at CUNY, across the country, going back to the 40s and 50s, the Rap Coup d'Air investigations, which resulted in hundreds of New York City public university professors and teachers being fired for their, you know, membership in the Communist Party or alleged membership in the Communist Party. In the 60s, we know, you know, CCNY, Brooklyn College, 69, there were the deoccupations, Black and Puerto Rican liberation struggles that, you know, calling for Black and Puerto Rican studies, open admissions, in making sure that CUNY was accessible to the working class Black and brown communities in which the university is embedded. And that also resulted in repression. People faced, you know, all kinds of ridiculous trumped up felony charges at the time. And now we see it again. Why? Because the student movement is successful. Go back to those videos of the encampment. Of course, that didn't come out of nowhere. You know, it's been happening for years, this kind of organizing, and the Breonna Taylor, George Floyd uprisings, you know, the, you know, building on the shoulders of the Black and Puerto Rican liberation struggles, indigenous struggles. But, you know, most recently with the genocide and students really calling out, you know, the complicity of their institutions, the propaganda of bourgeois media and the lies manufacturing consent for war. And, you know, they called out the emperor's, you know, not wearing any clothes. And that's why they need to be repressed. So this fascist repression is a sign of desperation. And you know, actually at CUNY, another win, as Hadika said, we have to uplift our wins. CUNY law student Sarah Southey was just successfully sued CUNY for to have our CUNY's institutional investments disclosed. And now CUNY is forced to. They rejected a FOIL, and now they are going to be forced to, under the law, to reveal those investments. And we are going to, you know, we will not stop. We will not rest until CUNY is divested, right, and they can try and get rid of us. Like Hadika said, we're not going anywhere. We're going to make sure that you know, this institution lives up to this name it claims of being a people's university.
Right. Yeah. You were arrested, Karina. Tell us about the arrest, what the conditions were like.
Yeah, and actually, I think yours was one of the few programs that covered our press conference, if I remember correctly, and I really appreciate that. I just want to say I'm a huge fan of your work in general. I was arrested in the night of April 30th, along with over 100 people who were arrested at the encampment. You know, we, some faculty had decided to stay behind. We linked arms. We tried to defend the students from this brutalization of the NYPD. The SRG were sent on campus. You know, it was horrible. I myself didn't experience any of the violence, but it was all around me. I saw people getting beaten on the ground. People had broken bones. What Hadika was saying about women getting their hijab ripped off. It happened when we were in the jail. In fact, there was an incident of a woman screaming and her hijab was ripped off. All kinds of brutalization happened that evening. It was horrific. It was like a military raid. Almost 200 cops came onto that encampment for what? Again, a bunch of young people and community members protesting a genocide. It was a horrific use of state violence, and really exposed, the university's entanglements with the police state. Because, you know, it really raises questions over, you know, whose interest does this university run? And also makes us think about that, like, materially. And that's you know, part of a big, you know, that's what the BDS movement is about, thinking about the material connections, but also our board of trustees, our chancellor. Why do we have a board of trustees comprised of real estate moguls and Wall Street financiers? You know, they don't represent CUNY. They don't represent our communities. And so, of course, they're going to make decisions that benefit capital, that benefit empire, that benefit settler colonialism, and that, you know, are detrimental and fundamentally at odds with the interests of our students and our workers and our communities.
Yeah. I mean, it's so fascinating because, again, as I referred to earlier, it is really, it's almost like they're doing us a favor by one, showing how desperate they are, but also showing us the intersections between all these movements, which is, yeah, thank you for making the case for us, capital, real estate, Zionists, all of the above. And Hadika, what else do you want to tell us about what you've been going through, what you're working on now? And then I want to ask both of you if you could just explain, you know, something we haven't discussed, but for people who may not understand this, like how CUNY is invested both morally and financially in Zionism.
Yeah,
in the occupation.
I think I'll lead with that because that's sort of the root of all of it. CUNY has over $1.1 million in weapons manufacturers like Northrop Grumman and Boeing that, you know, that was from records that we've had from years. But now that we have this new foil and this new opportunity, I think all of us can say that we would only assume that it's increased and it's gotten even more because we've seen the stocks of these weapons manufacturers and all of these companies increase exponentially in the start of this genocide, in the most recent genocide. And so the millions of dollars in investments, but also the constant ties, you know, we talk about the ties with NYPD and all these state officials, but there's also on-campus ties with Zionist groups like Hillel that frame themselves as, you know, peaceful Jewish organizations, but they are really there to promote Zionist agendas. And they're there to, you know, further harass pro-Palestine students on campus. And they're the same, you know, groups that are engaging in with CUNY in so-called birthright trips and Fulbright trips to Palestine to go settle on more land and call it theirs. So there's so much ingrained investments and bloodshed within what we're doing. And, you know, we have so many campaigns targeted at these different things. I will highlight another recent win, a small one, but a beautiful one, is that at City College, after the encampment was raided, the president of the college, Vincent Bougereau, he thought it was a great idea to take all of that feedback from students and faculty and decide to put a Nestle and Starbucks within the campus and further invest in genocide more. These are companies that have extensive records of investments in genocide and complete war crimes that they have committed, whether it be in Congo, whether it be in the Ivory Coast, whether it be in Palestine. And so we had launched a boycott campaign where we partnered with local businesses and coffee shops in Harlem to both promote the small businesses around us and build those connections in Harlem for Black businesses, for young small businesses, but also as a means of boycotting our university and the coffee shop on campus. And we ended up getting divestment from that. They saw that we hit them where it hurts, which is in their pockets. And so that ended up getting foiled and we got that business out, which was, I think, a really good model to frame collectively how we want to move forward, which is that, like, it's shown us how much power we do have. You know, I think a lot of us see, like, all right, what's one, you know, missing out on Coca-Cola going to do, or what's one protest going to do, or what's one, you know, teach-in going to do. But it really is, we're putting in the work and it's making a difference. And I just really want to highlight that it does matter and it's working. And so at the moment we are currently both in, I think Karina and I are both in appeal processes. I had appealed to initially the president of City College to drop all the charges against my suspension, which were bogus, and he denied it, which I would like to also state, you know, the history of that, which is that Vincent Bougereau is somebody who has built a career, who has profited off of this aesthetic and this brand of activism. He has framed himself in his career, in every book that he's written, as this revolutionary who is so, you know, so bold and supports resistance and supports protest. And he himself also has bragged several times about the fact that he was arrested over 20 times during his time in undergrad at Cornell University for setting up encampments and protesting Cornell University's complicity and investments in South African apartheid. He's the same college president who called the cops to brutalize us. He's the same college president that has denied my appeal, who had decided to suspend me. He's the same college president that is continuing to make such repressive decisions on the student movement while he actively, you know, parades around this banner of being such a, you know, amazing revolutionary activist. I think it's so telling of exactly what we're working with, right? We have people within the institution that is literally funding and profiting off of a genocide, claiming and trying to co-opt and these phrases like revolution and resistance. But we know that that really lies in the hands of the people. And so we're collectively taking my case and escalating it to an appeal to the Board of Trustees. And so it's currently in appeal stages with them. And in October, we're going to have another Board of Trustees meeting to push and call for them to drop all of the charges against me. For me, I will say personally, I wear this like a badge of honor. I am not in any way, you know, regretful. I am more than fine. It is an honor for me and for all of us to sacrifice for Gaza. You know, I inshallah can get to claim that I stood on the right side of history. And that is something that I'll continue to work towards. But in order to make sure that they don't get away with this repression and to make sure that it doesn't further escalate, we are challenging this now. And so we're going to continue to do that both with my case and with all of the open cases that unfortunately we're seeing every day. Karina and I are checking Signal and there's more and more situations happening where we're like, oh my God, we got to start another campaign now. Right. With mine and with Karina's, we're in appeal stages. And so now is the time to put pressure on the university, one, to drop these charges and end this repression, but also 100% in the name of divestment and in the name of divesting from the over $1.1 million in weapons manufacturers that are murdering Palestinians on a daily basis as we speak right now on the 703rd day of a genocide, with over 400,000 Palestinians being murdered.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that someone can brag about protesting apartheid then and then punishing the people protesting apartheid now.
Yeah.
There's
no excuse. And it's honestly, it's probably worse, right? In my opinion, it's worse than somebody who were to openly say, like, I am a Zionist and I don't like you guys, so I'm going to get rid of you. It's somebody who's claiming and trying to act like they're our friend and trying to be on our side and also claim the aesthetics of our movement while actively standing against us. It's something that we see right through.
Right.
And made a career off of it.
Right. Yeah. It's sordid. Thank you guys so much for what you do and for your time. Any final words from you? And we'd love to have you back on. So when I say final, I mean for this appearance. Yeah.
Yeah, I would just say, like Hadika said, there are quite a few cases right now. We're finding out new ones every day. Please continue to follow CUNY for Palestine. That's one thing. We post a lot of information on our social media. Also, there's the action letter for Hadika. We can share the links. There's an action letter for the Fired Four as well that our union, the PSC CUNY, which has been amazing and also fighting for the Fired Four. And there are now six. The Singed Six, five full-time faculty members and one staff member who are under investigation at Brooklyn College. So this goes to show you also what we've been saying all along, which is the adjunct firings are the canaries in the coal mine.
Right.
Please keep an eye on that. Do their action letter. There's also a statement you can find at the Anti-Imperialist Scholars Collective, which talks about all both the students and the faculty who have been harassed and retaliated against. And I would urge everyone to sign that. And most importantly, as Hadika said, you know, let's just keep talking about Palestine, keep talking about the genocide, do everything we can to support Palestinian liberation and to end U.S. imperialist interventions and, you know, the death and destruction.
Yeah. And I would also add that, you know, we have repression happening in every space that we can find, whether it be, you know, faculty being fired from our universities or, you know, we have Sister Ibtihad who was fired from Microsoft, you know, who stood up against genocide. We have people like Tariq Bazrouk who are actively like currently sitting in prison cells on bogus hate crime charges, who is also a CUNY student. He's a 20-year-old CUNY student who's actively facing hate crime charges, sitting in jail. And so we have several resources at CUNY for Palestine on our socials, on Twitter, on Instagram, that you can find to see how you can help and continue pushing and challenging the system that thinks that they can get away with repression in broad daylight.
Well, thank you. Yeah, this has been really inspiring. And thank you again for everything you do. Thank you for coming on the show. And it's really important, I think, like you were saying, to highlight the victories. I mean, this time of absolute, you know, without whitewashing what's happening, because we are living through a live stream genocide. But we do have to highlight victories. And this isn't even corny. I really think it's actually part of organizing. We have to highlight victories. We have to keep hope and remind people, because it really is like the least we can do. Given what's happening in Gaza. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
And good luck with everything. And we'll link to your, Brad, you'll put in the links to all their cases. Okay, great. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Have a good one. Take care.
You too. Bye, everyone. Have a great night. What a great show. Inspiring. Depressing at points, because it's a depressing world. But poignant. I mean, I think that there is a lot of very moving things that were said in both sections of the show, in the segment, in this section, certainly. It's really important to highlight victories, as we were saying. Okay, yeah, one thing I guess we should show, right as I said, I want to end on a note of highlighting victory, but we shouldn't show that there was two boats of the flotilla, the Samud flotilla, have been struck, was attacked. So that's, do you want to show? I guess we can show that footage, Brad. Okay, here we go. So you see the crew noticing a drone.
Everyone is okay. The fire
really
is
scary.
What we need to do right now is we need to verify whether or not it was a drone.
نقل لنا الخبر انه تم مجموعه من المسيرات حامت حول السفينه.
This ship was bombed. We are now on our way to verify. This attack represents a blatant attack on the Republic of Tunisia and its sovereignty. The ship was bombed by a drone. It dropped a bomb, which led to the burning of a large part of the ship.
We have heard the explosion. The information that has received, people are fine. Regardless of this, regardless of what happened today, we are still with high spirit. We are confident that we will continue with our path. We have taken the decision to move together with people from coming from more than 45 countries to mobilize. Our only focus is on Gaza. We have repeated so many times, whatever happens to us, any kind of risk we face, it's nothing compared to what happens in Gaza.
There was an incendiary device, some kind of incendiary device that was used on the ship itself. It caused a fire that was approximately 2 meters, went on for about 5 to 6 minutes. The crew who were on the ship were able to extinguish the fire themselves, thankfully. Thankfully, also, nobody was harmed. This is a violation of Article 2.4 of the United Nations Charter. In other words, an unlawful use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of another state. That would include, to be specific, the state of Tunisia, as well as the flag state of the vessel, which I understand is Portugal.
I was standing on the aft deck, the back part of the ship. There was a drone just above my head, maybe 3 or 4 meters above. And I called someone. Santi came over. We were both looking at the drone for a few seconds. It was hovering just over our heads. Then we saw it slowly moving to the forward part of the deck. When it was hovering on the above the forward deck, it dropped what was clearly a bomb. The bomb landed on the on a pile of life jackets, and there was a huge flame.
We will continue our preparation as soon as we make sure the ships are safe and the crew and the participants are safe. We will continue to break the siege on Gaza.
Okay, that was the other one. And then I believe we have another one, which the more recent one. Okay, so this is from tonight. The moment another Samud Gaza aid flotilla ship was attacked.
So it looks to me, Katie, like it was struck and there's a fire on the ship.
Yeah. All right. Well, what happened to those Italian dock workers, by the way? Weren't they going to shut everything down?
Well,
we got to find out.
I guess we need more Italian dock workers, clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't make that threat and then not follow through on it. Just saying. I mean, I like what they did. I like their statement, and I don't mean to throw shade at them, but I did think that they threatened to shut down all of Europe and block all shipments to Israel. Well, to be fair, I guess that was if communication was with the flotilla was that bound for Gaza was lost. But I would think that would include if we lose contact with our boats, with their comrades, even for just 20 minutes, we will shut down all of Europe. Now, I'm not sure if that includes drone strikes, bombs.
To be fair, since this literally just happened, I suppose.
We'll give them some time. Well, no, but one of them was yesterday.
I mean, I'm not an Italian dock worker, so I can't really speak to how long it would take to shut down all of Europe, but.
Okay. Well, I hope they're on it. And by the way, apologies if I'm outing them and this was going to be a sneak attack. I'm sorry. I don't mean to make light. This is serious stuff, but.
Trying to find some levity in a horrible. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think the levity was just, I think I've never, one of my favorite lines may be Bradley R. Bloom saying, I'm not an Italian dock worker, but
just to clarify, because anyway. I know I might come off like you might get that impression.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. From so many things. Yeah. Guys, thank you so much for being on, for joining the show. Thank you so much to our guests for coming on the show. Please like the stream if you haven't already. Please subscribe if you haven't already. To support the show, go to patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. And to see the full excellent, excellent, excellent interview with Seth Harp, go to patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Bye, everyone, and see you next week. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary, and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.